Spring is here and the birds are returning. But the roar of the leaf blowers is a big turnoff.
Right now, they're starting to migrate back in from Central and South America and either coming through or stopping to stay and breed. And if they're going to a spot where there's this constant noise, well, why are they going to want to nest there? And where are they going to nest? Because there's increasingly more and more spots like that.
That's Nancy Lawson. We talk with her about her book, Wildscape, Trilling Chipmunks, Beckoning Blooms, Salty Butterflies, and Other Sensory Wonders of Nature. Then, a historical novel set in Jane Austen's London reimagines the Pandora myth. Susan Stokes Chapman tells us about her novel, Pandora. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As Writer's Voice celebrates Earth Month, we're watching the Earth come alive with a new spring season. But how much of the wildscape around us do we really appreciate? How much of it can we truly see, hear, or smell? And how much of it are we disturbing and suppressing with our heedless pursuit of perfect lawns and gardens filled with fancy exotics? Naturalist Nancy Lawson's first book, The Humane Gardener, explored the importance of creating habitats for wildlife in our own backyards by creating diverse ecosystems with pollinator-friendly native plants and other wildlife-friendly practices. Her new book, Wildscape, takes us deeper into understanding the secret lives of the animals, insects, and plants that surround us. Lawson takes readers on a fascinating tour of the vibrant web of nature outside our back door, where animals and plants perceive and communicate using sensory abilities we're only beginning to understand. Organized into chapters investigating each of their five senses, Lawson's exploration reveals a remarkable world of interdependent creatures with amazing capabilities. Nancy Lawson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's great to be here.
You wrote the book, The Humane Gardener. Tell us about the connection between that book and this one, Wildscape.
Yeah, that book was an effort to help people understand the ways that their cultivation practices could be creating or exacerbating conflict with wildlife, while also kind of elucidating the main ways that people could attract wildlife. And so those two things are often considered separately. And I was trying to bridge the fact that you can do both of those things with plants, and specifically with native plants. You can resolve conflicts with wildlife oftentimes and also welcome them. And often people will be selective about who they want in their garden. So it was an attempt to explain why all of our local flora and fauna are important to welcome and nurture. And so my second book arose out of that. Over time, I explored some of the issues in the first book that became the foundation for the second book, but only in kind of a cursory way. And so I became more and more interested in how our, not just our cultivation practices, but kind of our lifestyle practices around our homes can disrupt the sensory environment for animals and plants, and how animals and plants perceive the world. Because if people could understand that, I feel like they could understand a lot better some of the recommendations for reducing your disturbance and mitigating your disturbance in the outdoor environment.
Yeah, you know, what's so brilliant about your book is precisely this, that it opens up the whole world of the non-human senses to us so that we no longer see these creatures as enemies or inanimate objects in some way, but we actually are more aware of our world. But what struck me and hurt my heart so much was then with this awareness, just to understand on so many levels how we are disrupting this wildscape. And I just want to give you a brief example. As I was preparing for this interview this morning, the buzz of the gas leaf blowers started as they always start. Now, I live in the middle of the woods, but there are houses not too far away. I've always hated them. But now that I've read Wildscape, I'm really angry.
Yeah.
You cover the soundscape, among other things. So just start out there. Tell us what gas leaf blowers are doing to the wildlife. And I know it's more than sound, and I know it's more than just gas leaf blowers, but let's start with them.
Yeah. So I've always really disliked them passionately too. Partly, you know, because when they first became more popular, they really hurt our ears too. But I worked at an animal welfare organization for years, and sometimes when I would arrive at work, there would be guys out there blowing the leaves under the cars and like doing things that weren't even necessary because they're fulfilling the services of a contract, you know. And I'm sitting here like, this is an animal welfare organization, and even we're doing this. And I started to look at that time, that was probably 20 years ago, trying to figure out what's the research on noise pollution. And even to this day, most of the research is focused on chronic noise. Like they'll use either real traffic situations, or they'll play the sound of traffic when they're trying to discern the effect on animals. They'll do studies around near natural gas compressors and such. And so when I was interviewing people and reading studies, I was trying to figure out, well, is anybody working on this kind of what they consider acute noise, which is this intermittent leaf blowing and mowing? And mowers have gotten, you know, it's so industrialized now, oftentimes, you know, whole communities will be invaded by these trucks full of guys with leaf blowers and huge mowers. And so at some point, the acute is becoming chronic, and especially seasonally, you know, when we start to hit the high season. And so when I would ask the researchers, you know, they would explain to me why it's hard to assess that and quantify that, but that they do think it's got to be having a profound effect. First of all, you know, animals avoid loud noises. And I mean, around the world, they're finding migratory birds will avoid noisy areas. And I mean, if you just think about in your home landscape, birds coming back right now, they're starting to migrate back in from Central and South America and either coming through or stopping to stay and breed. And if they're going to a spot where there's this constant noise, well, why are they going to want to nest there? And where are they going to nest? Because there's increasingly more and more spots like that. And so one of the things that I also was doing during the pandemic as I was writing this book was, you know, sitting still by the pond and trying to figure out, we made a little pond and I would sit under a walnut tree, and I would just, during those times when my neighbors weren't making those noises, I would try to figure out what are all the different things that I can hear. And if you look at a decibel scale, the rustling leaves are almost on the lowest end and the leaf blowers are almost on the highest end. And, you know, the very things that take those leaves away, and what's happening in those leaves? Well, there's squirrels in there burying their nuts. There's birds like brown thrashers that you never get to see. Well, because they're so shy, you might hear them, but you don't usually see them. And I would have all these experiences with seeing like frogs in Amplexus mating and hopping down the path, because I became just part of the background. And so when I was looking at the studies on this, there are just some really profound effects on health and fitness among all sorts of animals. I mean, there's reduced egg hatching and bluebirds and tree swallows. There's been studies on those species. There's a decreased foraging efficiency of owls and bats. And there's these sort of counterintuitive things at first where, you know, around the gas compressors, they found that there's a lower presence of insects and spiders near the noise, but there's a higher presence of mice, because when they go near the noise, they know that their activity can be masked by predators. And, you know, birds reduce their vocal ranges to try to compete with the frequency, and that could affect their mates who they're attracting. It could affect how their competitors see them. Are they not as a robust bird as they would normally be because they're only hearing this limited vocal range? And so it's astounding when you really look at the ripple effects too of how that can affect seed dispersal. If birds are avoiding an area, they're not planting pine seeds, and it can decrease the forest community or change it.
So just such a broad range of impacts. And I said before, it's more than just the noise. Of course, I have taken to leaving my leaves on the ground until in my garden. I live in the middle of the forest, so I don't even clear any leaves for most of it. But I'll wait until May before I really rake off the leaves. And then what I'll do is I'll grind them up and kind of return them to the soil, at least so they can do some good. It's interesting. We talked about the soundscape. There's, of course, much more to say about that. But on the other hand, you say that the fact that humans are dominated by our visual sense, and we privilege our visual sense, leads us to suppress the habitats that animals and plants require. What's the connection between our visual dominance and what kinds of practices does that influence so that we suppress those habitats?
Yeah, so, I mean, say somebody is trying to save they see mildew on their bee balms and they spray a fungicide, or they want to keep their grass really lush and they put a bunch of fertilizer on it. Well, there's work that's been done that's showing that these things can affect bumblebees' abilities to forage, to find flowers. These different scents of some of these products either lead to maybe avoidance behaviors, or they confuse the bees, or they can alter scents. There's a study on diesel exhaust altering the scent of flowers so that honeybees have a hard time finding them. And so that's pretty new research, but I mean, that's just one example where we see something with our eyes. We think it's unsightly. And in that example that I just mentioned, mildew on bee balms is just a natural occurrence. It's just what happens with that plant. And then they come back and they bloom beautifully. And, you know, sometimes maybe they need more air, or they're in too much shade, but you can move the plant, and there are other things you can do. You don't have to mess with the scentscape like that. And so it happens with things like the touchscape, where, you know, people are piling mulch down around their plants or making those mulch volcanoes around trees. And, you know, where are the ground nesting bees going to go? Like 70% of our native bees are ground nesters. And if you're covering everything over with mulch, they can't get to the ground. They can't make their nests. And so there's just an amazing number of things that we do in the name of our own idea of aesthetics and what's beautiful that takes away from the animals' abilities to really live out their life cycles.
I feel so, what's the word, ambivalent hearing you, because there are certain practices as a gardener, and I don't mean just gardening for flowers. I mean, when I garden for flowers, I'm definitely thinking about the pollinators. But I also garden for food. And if I don't put down some mulch, then with the increasingly hotter summers we have, my plants will die.
Yeah. Well, what kind of mulch do you use? You know, I think that's...
I try to put in leaf mulch.
Yeah. I mean, so if you're growing food, you know, that's also going to feed a whole lot of organisms. So, but you're not growing it in your forest, you're not growing it on your entire property, you know? So I think that just wherever people don't have to do this, wherever people can leave some space for the animals is really what I'm talking about here, because There are slightly different things that you do when you grow food, and you have to protect the plants more from getting eaten and such. But I like to help people think of, you know, growing the rest of their landscape as growing food for wildlife. And so I don't think it's all or nothing. I just think that it's actually treated as nothing most of the time in these suburban landscapes and even rural landscapes increasingly. I mean, I live pretty much in a place that was considered rural. It's really being built up now, but people still have 2 acre, 3 acre, 5 acre lots. And it's incredible how much they just mow. And part of it is that now it's affordable for a lot of people to just hire some of these industrial landscape companies to just, and there'll be three guys on big mowers at a time. I say guys because it mostly is. I think I saw one woman one time, but that's mostly what it is around here. And they just, it's just devastating, I think. And to your point about your forest around you, I mean, that's really interesting too, because I think it's something like 1/3 of native bees are being found to actually need a forest environment. And people don't often think of that. So, I mean, you're supporting bees even when you have shade and forest, because they need those spring ephemerals. They need the leaves. The bumblebees overwinter under there, the queen bumblebees. They need a lot. They need the tree and shrub flowers of native trees. And, you know, we don't often think about that because you got to look way up. And unless there's a branch that's low down that you can see, you don't often see all those bees in the spring. But that's their main food source in the spring. So,
this is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with naturalist Nancy Lawson about her new book, Wildscape. It's about the vibrant web of nature outside our back door, where animals and plants perceive and communicate using sensory abilities we're only beginning to understand. You know, it was interesting too. I mean, there's so much in this book, Wildscape. It's so, first of all, beautifully written, beautifully photographed, and loads of stuff that I knew nothing about. For example, dead plants are good. I still have my perennial dead stalks from the perennials from last year, because I'm waiting to trim them down to the ground because I know that they're still habitat. Tell us about the monarch butterflies and why they need dead plants and you know, what they produce with them.
That was a really interesting little discovery. In my garden in 2019, I was just sort of wandering around taking pictures lazily at night one night, and or in the evening, the sun was still up, and I saw a monarch on a late bone set, Eupatorium serotinum. And you know, you see monarchs on leaves and you think they're just perching, but he was on there for a while. And when I zoomed in, I realized he was, and it was a male, and he was putting his proboscis into the leaf and then scratching it with his foot around these holes that I later realized were holes made by flea beetles. And it turns out that they sometimes go to injured and drying plants to get substances referred to or called pyrrolizidine alkaloids. And these are chemicals that help the plant defend itself from browsing. So deer don't eat them very much. They can be hepatotoxic and accumulate in the liver. Rabbits don't eat plants with PAs in them. We call them PAs for short. Rabbits don't eat them very much either. But monarchs and other insects have figured out a way to extract these chemicals and synthesize them. And so a lot of butterflies and moths are doing this in the tropics. And there are other insects, some other like grasshoppers that do this. And it's thought that, well, they know that a lot of the related butterflies are doing it both to synthesize into pheromones and for defense. But Monarchs are using it just to for in their defenses because they don't need, they have a different way of courtship. And so it's not thought that they would use pheromones like that. Some insects will go to flowers and they'll get defensive chemicals while they're eating, or caterpillars will get them while they're eating. So monarch butterflies do at the larval stage get those defensive chemicals from milkweed, as we all know, but they're also eating. And so this is a specific behavior where they're going to these dried leaves as adults and getting them specifically to use basically as drugs.
That's so awesome. You know, I'd like to ask you about some of the creatures in the book that people reflexively try to destroy and why we shouldn't do that. For example, in the chapter on the tastescape, you talk about the cuckoos and the tent caterpillars. And of course, I've always just been totally creeped out by tent caterpillars, but now I'm not. What good are they?
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm so glad that it helped with that. And, you know, I think anything that's moving around en masse, we kind of have that reaction instinctively. But yeah, once you look up close and learn more about them, it's really interesting. And so yellow-billed cuckoos will find a spot to breed where there are these eruptions because they need a lot of caterpillars at once to feed their young. And so if you leave these tent caterpillar nests, these aggregations, and you leave the fall webworms, you're more likely to be able to help yellow-billed cuckoos in their nesting habits. And I also learned over the last few years while I was writing this book about the white flannel moth caterpillars, which are really beautiful. And they don't make tents, but what happens with them is that they come out en masse. They're red and yellow and black, and they have these long white hairs. So I learned you don't want to touch them. I didn't touch them. Thankfully, I learned before I touched them. But they come out en masse on trees like redbuds, and you see them crawling all the way up. You see them all over the leaves, and so cuckoos love that too. And when we have outbreaks, we have the cuckoos here nesting. And it's just a really lovely thing to be sitting here right around the same time of year and realize, oh, the cuckoos are calling, you know, they're back. And looking up in the cherry tree and see, oh yeah, that's because there's a tent caterpillar nest. You know, it's all connected.
So now I have to ask you about an animal that you like more than I do, and I don't think I'm going to change my mind about this one. As I told you before, I live in the middle of a forest, and it has been decimated, really decimated by deer. I mean, we have had, this house has been in my family since the 1960s, and the deer came in the 1980s, and I see the difference. You know, the forests are going silent. There are far fewer songbirds in the forest. There's only one plant in the understory anymore, and that is I forget what it's called, but it's related to the blueberry plant. In terms of native plants, I mean, we're getting very, very thorny vines coming in that never happened before, and we're getting other plants that I've noticed are garden plants that are invasive. But, you know, the only plants that are left are the ones that the deer don't eat. And you have some suggestions that I hadn't thought about for how to deal with this. But I do want to say that the deer are really destroying the ecosystem. I see it around me.
It would be interesting to see what that was. I mean, our lifespans are so short, and what that area was really like, you know, 400 years ago, 300 years ago, because a lot of the research that's been done on deer does not span that amount of time. And we don't really know the numbers of deer who were around in the past, and the spring ephemerals and such may have been a lot more sparse. I mean, we had this situation over the past century where they were almost extirpated completely. And so some of the growth that we saw was growth that was happening without them. And it would have not been happening without them before we almost hunted them out of existence. So I think that it's a complicated issue that goes beyond what we're just, you know, seeing in our limited lifetime in front of us. And
there is one difference. There used to be top predators. There used to be wolves. There used to be coyotes. We got rid of all of those. And I think the issue is population pressure.
Well, you know, that could be one issue, yeah. But we also have changed so much about the environment around us too. And as those forests age and they become more shady than they were, these old forests that were once farmland that became forests again are evolving too for other reasons as well. And, you know, we're just learning about just how many different other species we've introduced that aren't even native into our forests, like the invasive earthworms, and there's invasive slugs now, and the plants, of course, that we've introduced, as you mentioned, into our gardens. And so it's this whole dynamic that involves far more than deer. And of course, it all goes back to actions that we've taken. And so what I try to, you know, help people focus on, at least in my area and in the East Coast, is so this is the issue now. We have a lot of deer in our gardens. We have them in our surrounding forests. They're here to stay. I mean, even if you implement hunting in a community as a temporary control, it's not lasting. And sometimes they can rebound even more because of the way that they reproduce. And so what else can we do? And some of it will involve defensive strategies, so like caging young trees and shrubs until they're tall enough to withstand the browse. Some of it involves letting plants grow that are actually native, that people have just spent so long taking out, like the brambles, like the blackberries and the raspberries and these things that provide natural caging and allow for trees to sprout within them, and the shrubs act as kind of these nurse plants. I mean, I see this happening even in just my little 2 acres, and it's really exciting because it's like, oh, I didn't plant that tree at all. And furthermore, no one ate it because it's within the black raspberries, and now it's, you know, 7 feet tall. And so there's also, you know, things like just watching them, how they move along. They like to take the path of least resistance oftentimes, like we do. So if we have pathways where they move, you know, mixing in things that they will just really like with things that aren't so tasty, like the bone set that I mentioned earlier that has the PAs in it, or mountain mint, or things that are just things that they really aren't going to eat normally. Or if they do, they'll eat a little and be like, ew, that's gross, and move on.
Well, there's so much more in this wonderful book, Wildscape. Thank you so much. And we want to say, by the way, you also have a wonderful website, The Humane Gardener. I've been dipping into it with all kinds of wonderful information, and we will link to that on our website as well, writersvoice.net. So if you could just tell our listeners one or two things that you would like them to do right now in this season to help the wildscape, what would that be?
I would say that first, step back. You know, often we think we have to do something right away. What if we just stop and see what happens and who's visiting and what's coming up and what's growing, even if it's just a little patch that you do nothing to? And that helps you inform so many of your other decisions as you go forward.
Well, Nancy Lawson, your book is Wildscape, Trilling Chipmunks, Beckoning Blooms, Salty Butterflies, and Other Sensory Wonders of Nature. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Here's an excerpt from Nancy Lawson's book, Wildscape. Your outdoor surroundings are a vibrant universe, a place where many languages are spoken, sometimes in sensory alphabets. we humans have hardly even begun to decipher. It's swirling with hidden messages, ephemeral molecules spelling out an invitation or piecing together a cry for help. Ultrasound clicks you can't hear and ultraviolet colors you can't see. Calls of alarm, distress, defense, and companionship that reach your ears but require a translator to decode. If you treat the local environment like the homeland it's meant to be, you'll be exposed to more cultures and ideas and ways of life than if you visited with people from every country in the world. Butterflies will land on your toes, and fireflies will court on your knees. You'll cross paths with beetles who spend months raising their children, living together as families long after their young have hatched. You'll see hummingbirds make extraordinary swooping flights to impress their beloveds, and mourning doves building their nests together. You'll watch a fox eating tidbits from the grass in the early morning sunlight and feel a rabbit hop over your shoe as the evening settles in. You'll hear the anthems of frogs and bluebirds declaring the spring season, and you'll sit among hooting owls and shooting stars closing out the year in December. You'll see that your yard and your community green spaces are not really yours at all, but the gathering place of countless sovereign nations, a refuge for the increasingly displaced. Faced with the blare and glare of extraneous human interference, many would-be habitats are stunted before they ever really get off the ground. Noise pollution, light pollution, lawns, and other negative byproducts of superficial human progress are disrupting the connections among flora and fauna, as well as our own ability to connect with the nature in our communities. But your space can be different once you stop trying so hard to defend its borders and start looking at the world from the perspectives of other beings who live there. That was an excerpt from Nancy Lawson's book, Wildscape. Nancy Lawson. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to her website, The Humane Gardener. Next up, a novel set in Georgian England about the myth of Pandora. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The ancient Greek myth of Pandora is a cautionary tale about the dangers of female curiosity. Curiosity that unleashes all the ills that plague man. But what if that curiosity is actually a strength, one that expresses the power of female creativity? That's a theme explored in Susan Stokes Chapman's debut novel, Pandora. A historical novel with touches of gothic horror, good old-fashioned mystery, and a fascinating look at the illegal trade in antiquities in London in 1799, Pandora is a cinematic and compelling work of fiction where the discovery of a mysterious ancient Greek vase sets in motion conspiracies, revelations, and romance. Susan Stokes Chapman is a writer based in North Wales. Pandora was first published in the UK in January 2022 and became an instant number one bestseller. It was published by Harper Perennial in the US in January. Susan Stokes Chapman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this novel, Pandora, it was a delight to read. It takes place in the Georgian era. So for us ignorant Americans, first place us there. When was the Georgian era and why did you want to write a novel situated in that time?
Sure. So the Georgian era, it's a very long period of history. It starts from around 1714 and actually goes through all the way to the 1830s. So yeah, you're looking at quite a long period of time. And you have obviously the Hanoverian king, Sir George the First, through to George the Fourth, and then William actually is aside, but everybody forgets about him. But it's Yeah, it's such a rich era. And I knew really I wanted to set this novel, and any novel I write actually, in the Georgian period, partly because, it's a very sort of cliched answer, I first became passionate about the era because in 1995, must have been about 9 or 10, I watched the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, and I fell completely hook, line and sinker for the era. I mean, obviously, being that age, being still a child, I was watching it very much through rose-tinted glasses. You know, I was looking at the romance of it and with how elegant and beautiful the whole thing was. And to be fair, it wasn't really until episode 5 that we ever got any inkling that there was a darker kind of period to the era, because we don't see we don't really see any of the kind of dirty, dark London, aside from when Darcy is tracking Wickham and Lydia down in the city. So I was very much looking at Pride and Prejudice as balls and, you know, the elegant outfits and the beautiful country houses. It wasn't until later that I realised there was a seedy underbelly to the Georgian period, as with any period, to be perfectly honest, because obviously, you know, whether it's Tudor, Victorian, modern day, there's always going to be different areas of the social sphere, I suppose, that we need to be looking at. But yeah, the Georgians really kind of captured my imagination, and I started doing a lot of research into the period. At university, I took a lot of Romanticism modules. So that's basically the modules that covered the poems of Keats and Byron and Shelley. And it involved a lot of contextual research, I suppose, to understand why those poets were writing what they were. And as I said, it just became such a black hole of research that I could really kind of dig my teeth into. And yeah, I just know that anything I write is going to be in the Georgian period. I just find the whole thing such a joy to research and write about. But obviously, this is Pandora and it's a Greek myth. And I do get asked the question quite a lot, why?
Well, we'll dig down more deeply into that aspect of this novel. But first, just to continue a bit on what you have been just talking about, I remember that series very well, by the way, and I totally loved it. You know, you're really talking about issues of class and also gender. So expound a little bit on that in relationship to this novel.
Of course. Well, Pandora of the novel, so Dora Blake, she is not rich by any means. She is essentially living in poverty in the very dilapidated and antiquity shop of her uncle. The shop was prosperous at one point. It used to belong to her parents, but they died tragically in an archaeological dig gone very wrong some years before. And since, the uncle Hezekiah has essentially taken over the shop and has let it go to rack and ruin. So Dora is kind of just living in this hovel of a shop, essentially. So she doesn't have any money of her own, and obviously that's because of her gender. So I am, of course, writing about a woman in the 18th century. And while I wanted to give Dora, and obviously the mythical Pandora, some agency and some strength as a character, I still needed to be very aware of the restrictions of the era itself. So she is essentially her uncle's ward. So he is the one that's in full charge. He is the one that pays for everything. She has no freedom whatsoever, except the freedom that she must somehow make herself. So we're looking at a woman then who is lower middle class, let's say, and a woman who does not have any sort of agency, at least at the beginning of the novel, of her own. And I wanted to address that. I wanted to kind of consider the role of women in the 18th century. And yes, the social kind of class system as well. I mean, Dora is not the only one that represents the lower classes. I've covered quite a few areas of the social scale. Quite early on, you see Hezekiah down at the docks, And you're seeing quite a few laymen there and the kind of jobs that they would have to do. And then we have Edward Lawrence in his bookbindery, and we see some workers there. The only hint of the rich and powerful, I suppose, comes in the form of Lady Latimer. And Lady Latimer is a very Lady Catherine de Bourgh-esque sort of character, actually, but a bit nicer, I think. She is very rich. She has her own money and therefore power. So even though she's not married, the money itself gives her power. And so being a female but rich in the 18th century didn't necessarily matter, in the sense of, because she had money, she could do what she liked. And she enables Dora to rise, essentially.
Yeah, exactly, because Dora, that is short for Pandora, her dream is to become a success at her jewelry designs, her jewelry designer. And so she gets a chance to do that via this jar, this ancient Greek jar. Describe the jar and also tell us why it's not a box.
Okay, well, so the jar itself in the novel is absolutely massive. So we're talking about a jar that would have come quite high to a person's chest or even shoulders, depending on the height of them. And it is described in the novel as a pithos. So when you're reading it, in my head, certainly, I was calling it pythos in my head for a very long time, but that is actually pronounced pithos. And essentially, this was a clay terracotta vase that tended to hold wine or grain. But this particular vase has on it the sort of inscriptions and patterns on it that essentially give Dora her design ideas for her jewellery. It depicts the actual creation of the Pandora of legend herself, and it features Zeus and Hephaestus and Prometheus, all of the people that are key characters in the Pandora myth. And in terms of why this isn't a box and it is a vase, it's actually quite simple. The term Pandora's box, it's something that we've known about, no matter whether you're a classicist or not. It's something that is just ingrained in us in some form or another. We've all heard of the terminology. And the general premise is that Zeus, the god of gods, he gives Pandora, the first woman, a box. Basically says, don't ever open it. She does open it, and all of the evils of the world come out. And so, mortified by what she's done, she slaps the lid back down, leaving hope inside. We all know the general idea. But it actually turns out that the word box was a mistranslation. So the 16th century philosopher Erasmus, he was translating Hesiod's Tales, in which the Pandora myth is originally depicted. And he's translating it into Latin. And the Latin word for the vase was pithos. And obviously that's why I chose the vase to be a pithos specifically. But instead of writing down pithos, he actually used the word pyxis, which means box. And so instead of it being Pandora's vase, it became Pandora's box. And that's what we've known ever since. But I wanted to use the original myth for this. I wanted it to be correct in that sense. And that is essentially why in the novel, the vase is a vase.
You know, it's so interesting. I didn't know that Pandora, according to myth, was the first woman. I see a parallel, basically, to the Christian legend of the Garden of Eden. I mean, similarly, Eve unleashes the evils, you know, or subjects human beings to the evils of the world because she transgresses as well. And did you think about those connections?
I didn't think about those connections. No, it's a very, very good point there. I must confess, I am not particularly religious myself, so that's probably why it didn't cross my mind. But you are absolutely right, the parallels are there. But it's interesting, really, isn't it, that women, whether it's in Christian myth or Greek myth, they are very much considered a villain. here, aren't they? I mean, Greek myths themselves, they're very misogynistic in nature, and women are either depicted as a victim or a villain. And for the novel, I wanted to readdress that. So Pandora, her curiosity in terms of opening the vase, it was considered very much a sin. So curiosity is a sin in this sort of timeline of events. But I wanted to turn that on its head and essentially give curiosity the idea that it was actually a strength. And so Pandora, or Dora Blake in the novel, I wanted to kind of, you know, readdress and realign and kind of flip that idea that women are evil and turn it into them being a source of strength and hope. And yeah, but no, it's a very, very interesting parallel that you've seen there. And yes, you are absolutely right. And then she was obviously sidelined for Eve, and then Eve takes things into her own hands, and that curiosity by taking the apple was considered a sin. So it's, and then Eve obviously having the apple and taking it because she was curious herself, and of course that then is considered evil. And yes, it's a very, very interesting way that women have been perceived in all iterations of ancient legend.
So Susan Stokes Chapman, in Pandora, you kind of skirt the horror genre without really going more than a tiny bit of a toe in, with intimations that Pandora's jar is cursed. And we should say that this jar, it's implied that this jar is, in fact, the original true Pandora's jar. Why didn't you go further into the supernatural?
I suppose because I don't want to be considered a fantasy writer. And I'm also, by the fact that I have such a passion for the Georgian era as well, I didn't want to go too far beyond the realms of reality. I wanted the novel to be able to look at certain events and ask, was this myth? Was this superstition? Was this magic? And still give a logical explanation as to why potentially it couldn't be that. As a reader, I quite like ambiguous endings and being encouraged to think about the answers to these sort of questions. I didn't want to kind of tie it all very, very neatly into a bow and say this is absolutely 100% Pandora's vase. I wanted there to be some sort of deliberation for the reader and an open-ended element to the novel. And because I wouldn't necessarily consider myself an historian, but I do consider myself an historical fiction writer, not a fantasy writer. So that's why I didn't want to go too far into the fantasy element.
And yet it does seem, you know, you rather hint more on that side than less, because we have Dora's pet bird, a magpie named Hermes, who is totally freaked out by this jar.
I believe animals always know, I think. I said earlier that I'm not particularly religious, but I am a little bit superstitious, and I have experienced small kind of little events that make me question things. And usually if I've got an animal around me where these events have happened, they know, they have this inkling. And I wanted to put that in the novel. And I think animals are very good at somehow reading between the lines and kind of just sensing things that I think as adults we might not necessarily interpret in the same way. You're right, I probably do lean towards the fantasy a bit more than the logical. I did like that element of it, certainly, and it made it a joy to write. I just wanted to hint and kind of lay the breadcrumbs without outright saying yes, because there are points throughout the whole novel, as I said earlier, they could very easily be answered away. There is a logical explanation behind everything. But it's always more fun, isn't it, to ask, well, what if? What if it was this? I think we would have lost the charm of the novel if I had gone full, no, this is absolutely not what this is. So, yeah, I wanted that kind of lighter, fun element there by really making us wonder.
And I think you hit the right balance, because to go more into the supernatural, as you say, would have really changed what this novel was about.
Exactly, exactly.
But now tell us about Edward Lawrence. You mentioned him before, Pandora's romantic interest. And without getting too much into the plot, because this is a mystery story after all, tell us about his investigation into the black market in antiquities and what interested you about this. And I know you did research about this. What was so interesting for you about this? What surprised you when you studied it?
It's such an interesting piece of history, actually, that sometimes even now we pretend not to know about. Basically, it originally kind of started in the sense of me trying to figure out how to actually get a mythical ancient Greek vase to Georgian London. And because like I said, I always knew I was going to write in the Georgian era. I loved the idea of Pandora's box, and I did try to think, well, how can I actually mix the two? So this is going back to what I hinted at earlier in the sense of why, how, you know, how do these two mix? And so finding out that Pandora's box was a mistranslation and it was actually a vase, a pithos, I thought, right, how then can I get this vase over to Georgian London, as I said? So the Georgians were absolutely fascinated by the ancient world. It was evident in their choice of fashions in the Regency era. Pandora is set in 1799, so we're on the cusp of the Regency era. And the fashions had already changed to the very loose and light dresses that started under the bust as the Empire line is how we know it. And those are very reminiscent of the togas and the very loose-fitting clothing of the ancient world. It was evident in their buildings, so the architecture. Many 18th century buildings, for instance, at the entrance, they would have these very elegant columns, so the kind of Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian architectural designs here, that they were very much evident in the buildings of the Georgian period. Same with some of the jewellery and the cameos, as I've mentioned in the novel as well. And it all really stems from their love of antiquity. So in the Georgian period, many of the aristocracy would go on something called the Grand Tour. That was typically for males of money who were sent abroad with their tutor or a close family member, essentially to educate them in the ways of the world. And so this was probably where many of these ideas kind of originated from, so that these men of quality would go overseas and see these things and bring them back to Britain. And this included antiques. One of the people that did this was William Hamilton. And William Hamilton is he's a real character, real person, and is a character in the novel. William Hamilton, he was basically a British envoy, and he worked under King Ferdinand in Naples. And he was an avid collector of Greek antiquity, vases in particular. And he would often fund excavations. He'd be heavily involved in them. He amassed a massive collection of antiquities, and he brought them into his own collections and sold them off. And he donated quite a few pieces to the British Museum. So many of the pieces that he donated can be seen there today. But when Napoleon was on the brink of invading Naples, he decided to ship the rest of his collection back to England. And he did this on a naval ship called the HMS Colossus. And the irony of it is that the ship sank just outside the Scilly Isles. And that is essentially how the vase got to England. But to answer your question more specifically, it's very interesting that these sort of things happened. Essentially, what William Hamilton was doing was illegal. He was pillaging foreign tombs, and he was claiming the items as his own. in the novel, this is actually touched upon. Napoleon did very much the same sort of thing, but Napoleon seemed to want to keep everything for himself. And William Hamilton, when being told that, actually, wait a minute, don't you think that you're doing exactly the same thing? He was like, no. I've done everything above board. I have shared this collection with the world, whereas Napoleon wanted to keep it. But at the end of the day, it's actually still very much the same thing, isn't it? And it's something that we do still do today, I suppose. And it's evident as well in the sense that many countries are actually asking for these items back. And this is an example of that would be the Elgin marbles that were taken from Pompeii. That, you know, that they're in the British Museum, and the country wants them back. And Edward Lawrence, he is a young antiquarian scholar. He is desperate to be part of the Society of Antiquaries. And so in terms of all this black market information, I had to research, as I said, how the vase got to England, and that's where William Hamilton came up. But I also had to research the Society of Antiquaries as well. And this whole black market sort of subplot just came up from that, and it linked everything perfectly, you know, Hezekiah and his business with the, you know, with the antique shop. But yeah, it was a very, very fascinating part of the research, and I could have kept going with that for ages. But it's very interesting, yes, to see how we perceive ourselves, how William Hamilton did not think he was like Napoleon, and yet he was in many ways. It's essentially, it's theft, and it's removing treasured pieces from another country's culture. And it's such a shame, and something, as I said, that we kind of do still do today. It's relevant, I think.
Absolutely. And it's part of what makes this novel charming as it is, cinematic as it is. I could really see it as a movie. Also so interesting with its historical detail. The novel is Pandora. We've been speaking with the author, Susan Stokes Chapman. Thank you so much for talking with us here. It's been delightful.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Susan Stokes Chapman. Go to writersvoice.net to hear an audio sample from Pandora. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.